into green belt for the nth time. How many times? I wouldn't ask. Dave Tomlinson.
Good afternoon. I'm amazed that there are so many of you here, given the fiasco behind this session being rescheduled. I was actually tempted to stand up and say that actually this session isn't going to happen now. It's moved to Monday at 3:15. But my wife said that would be really sick. So thank you, those who've patiently followed and maybe been twice to hear me and I wasn't here. And this is going to happen now. Short of some other disaster. I'm speaking about Reenchanting Christianity. Lots of you have had one of these little flyers. This is my new book, which was supposed to be here and on sale. but there were no fire extinguishers. The publishers tragically have missed their deadline. And so it's actually going to be out next week, when Greenbelt often is, isn't it? A week later. So that's why you got a flyer instead of a book. So I said to my wife when I walked back after coming to see some of you at 9:30 last night and say I wasn't here, it's not going very well, this, is it? I hope this book grows better than it's been born. But anyway, I am talking about this. In many ways, although I've had a couple of other books written since the post-evangelical, this is the book I've kind of always intended to write as a kind of follow-on from the post-evangelical. And in it, I suppose in a way, if you said that the post-evangelical was a kind of moment of disenchantment, then this, you know, is my moment of re-enchantment. In it, I am offering my own kind of interpretation of many of the big subjects of Christianity, really, I suppose, but in very small soundbite forms. So I'm reinterpreting things like the atonement, the resurrection, the virgin birth, our relationship with other faiths, prayer, and I'm not going to talk about all these things here today because I couldn't possibly do it in this session. You'll have to get the book to find out what I'm saying about all those things. But what I want to do is to talk about what I would see as the kind of underlying theological and spiritual posture of the book, which I call progressive orthodoxy. So I'm going to sort of explain a bit about that and what I mean by that. That's kind of, in a way, been the kind of guiding principle, if you like, throughout my kind of writing of the book. Lenny Bruce, the poet, famously once said, "Every day people are straying away from the church and going back to God." He said that a long time ago, but I sort of suspect that it's still very true. People today are no less spiritual than they were in the past, but I think they certainly are a lot less religious, at least in a formal sense. A disconnect has occurred between religion and spirituality. People no longer see religion or church as a natural setting in which to explore or express their spiritual aspirations. So they're drifting away from churches in droves. However, they're not doing this because they no longer believe in God, necessarily, or because they have no hunger or interest in the spiritual aspects of life, but because they don't find in Christianity, or their perception of Christianity, or the church, either a faith that they can believe in, or an existential spirituality that inspires or grips their very souls. Many people long to reconnect with the sacred mystery of life, to discover their place in the cosmos, but they don't see church or religion as a way of achieving this or pursuing it. Reenchanting Christianity is written for people both inside and outside of the church who want to discover a reenchantment with Christianity, who want to find fresh ways to think and feel about the Christian faith, who want to connect their faith with other aspects of their life and experience when often they feel that the two don't kind of exist together. I'm arguing that for this to happen, two things are necessary. First, we need to identify ways to interpret Christian belief that makes sense to us today. And secondly, we need some kind of spiritual renewal, because re-enchanted faith is, yes, about finding fresh ways to think and believe, but it's also about finding a spirited faith. One of the main causes of disenchantment with Christianity is the attitude of insularity that's found in many churches where faith exists in a kind of bubble, really, virtually uninfluenced by the insights, wisdom and sensibilities of the emerging culture of the 21st century. For faith to flourish, it has to engage, I believe, in a vigorous conversation both with its own past and with contemporary culture. It's about looking both backwards and forwards. Christian faith must neither amount to a simple repetition of past doctrinal formulations, nor a mere echoing of present attitudes, but in fact a vigorous discussion between the two. But this isn't what we find in many churches. Yesterday I passed one, the day before yesterday, I passed a church in Kentish Town, close to where I live, that described its mission on the notice board as pleading for a return to New Testament Christianity. And I want to say why. Why plead for a return to New Testament Christianity? I think we don't need a return to New Testament Christianity. What we need is a progression toward 21st century Christianity. A faith that's rooted in the past, yes, but radically contextualized in the present. We have to start living here and now in the present in our Christian experience. It's time to stop arguing about whether the church should consecrate women bishops. It's time to stop treating gay people as pariahs in the church and start getting on with the business of spreading a culture of life and liberation in the world. A poster on the tube, which I don't even know what it's for, but I just caught it, says something like, gay people are here, get used to it. I think we could add, women have a calling from God to priesthood and episcopacy, get used to it. For goodness sake, let's move on. The basis of re-enchanting Christianity is that many people inside and outside the church are disenchanted with Christianity, and in particular with the old interpretations of the faith that fail to engage creatively and credibly with the world of the 21st century. The ancient Hopi people of North America have a fascinating rite of passage for their children as they move into young adulthood. Throughout their life, these children have been familiar with the Kachinas, the tribe's masked holy men, who bless the corn harvest and bring toys and gifts for the children, a bit like Santa Claus. But one night, as the children are brought to the sacred circle, something different occurs. On this occasion, instead of being given gifts, the Kachinas simply remove their masks, revealing the fact that these figures, whom the children thought were gods, are actually family members and neighbours, people who they see every day. It's a moment of sacred disenchantment, where childish naivete gives way to grown-up reality. Sadly, the church doesn't offer an equivalent to the Hopi ritual. I've never been to a church where there is a service of disenchantment on the menu to help us to figure out what are the childish things about Christianity that should be left behind and what are the things that we need to hold on to and move forward with. For churchgoers, the process is a whole lot more messy and fraught, and yet it's essential. Indeed, paradoxically, experiencing disenchantment with the Christian faith is actually essential to growing as a Christian. It's the reality check that brings into question all that we've simply taken for granted. It's the acid bath that purges naive assumptions, false religious pretensions, and unthinking conformity. But what lies behind the disenchantment? What do we do when the mask is removed and we realise that things can't be the way they were or the way that we thought they were? This is what re-enchanting Christianity is about. One thing's clear, once the mask has been removed, it can never be put back into place again. The original innocence is gone and can never be restored. Does this mean that we're damned to eternal cynicism, an everlasting cycle of doubt and suspicion? Or is there, as I'm arguing, a second innocence, a means of re-enchantment? Can we still continue journeying confidently with the Christian faith, whilst also entertaining serious doubts and questions? When the young Hopi sees for the first time the face behind the mask, he or she must make a decision to treat the whole world of religion as a charade, a sick joke, or to move forward to a more adult reality in the rituals and symbols of their people, a reality that points to a deeper mystery. In 1 Corinthians 13, St. Paul points to a deeper mystery within Christianity, which we can't fully encounter in this life. What we experience now, he says, is like a poor reflection in a mirror, or an enigmatic riddle, the New Jerusalem Bible says. To pursue this deeper mystery through the riddles and symbols of the Christian faith, knowing that they themselves are not that mystery, is to follow the path toward a second innocence, a point of re-enchantment. And yet it's painfully clear that lots of people don't make it through to a second innocence. We're surrounded by people who used to believe, who used to go to church, but no longer do. Often it's because they're locked into interpretations of Christianity that they can no longer own or accept for themselves. This is very sad because, in truth, Christian tradition is so wonderfully rich and diverse. There are always other interpretations, other ways of looking at issues, other spiritual paths to explore, if only we know how to find them. The assumptions often made that those who struggle with doubts and questions, those who drift away from the church or even from mainstream Christianity, are in some way spiritually substandard, backsliders, that they lack the grit or the piety to persevere with the Christian faith. And yet the reality, you know, is so often the reverse. It's the doubters, often, the people who have outgrown the hand-me-down religious certainty and continue to ask the questions, who are actually on a genuine journey of faith. When I was a child, Paul says, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put away childish ways. We're not meant to remain the same, to stick with the same outlook on life, or to hang it onto the same old beliefs and attitudes, come what may. We're meant to grow as people. And as that growth occurs, all kinds of changes will come about in the way that we go about interpreting or applying our Christian faith. This can be very, very exciting and stimulating, but it can also be unnerving, both to ourselves and perhaps often to those people around us. So how do we go about connecting our Christian faith with other aspects of life and experience? This is the dilemma that I think we all have to face at some point on our journey. What do we do when values and attitudes, now taken for granted in the wider society, seem to conflict with the assumed teachings of the Bible or the traditions of the church? I mean, this is precisely the question, isn't it, behind the present melee in the church about homosexuality and women priests and bishops. But it's also the question behind the evolution versus creationism argument, or behind disputes over StelSAM research or abortion, or whether Christians can practice yoga and any amount of other great dilemmas in life. It's about a clash of cultures, a conflict of authorities. Those on the conservative side of the argument believe that Christian identity is under attack from a liberal secular agenda, whilst progressives feel that Christianity needs rescuing from those who want to lock it into the certainties of the past. The problem centres on what we think the historical character of Christian faith and theology to be. Christianity is a historical religion, we often hear said. No one can dispute this. But what does it mean? What does the phrase historical religion mean? Maurice Wiles, a former Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford, helpfully made the comment that historical can be understood in two ways. On the one hand, it might mean the Christian tradition is fixed, that we can't mess with it, that we're bound by the character or language or content of its origins. We're tied to the past, in other words. Or alternatively, historical could mean that Christianity is part of the changing patterns of history, that it's prepared to adapt itself to changing circumstances, and that making such changes will actually ensure its continuity and its vitality. But are we faced with an absolute choice between these two explanations of historical? Personally, I want to maintain that Christianity is an historical religion in both senses of the phrase, that the Christian faith is indeed radically dependent on the past, on particular historical events, but that it's also a living, evolving faith that must adapt to new situations, new circumstances, new insights. Robert Runcie, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, once said, "A church which listens only to its tradition will end up speaking only to itself. A church which listens only to what is happening in the world
will end up becoming only a dull echo of the latest liberal fashion. It is the interplay between tradition and discovery, he says, that creates a proper relevance. My own way of describing this third way of thinking about Christianity is to label it progressive orthodoxy, a faith that's fed and nurtured by a rootedness in past events, that's the orthodox bit, but which is also shaped and energized by a dynamic interaction with the world of the present, that's the progressive bit. Now, some people are going to object to the use of the term orthodox at all, on the grounds that the word inevitably smacks of rigidity and inflexibility, that it's intrinsically backward-looking. But I don't think this need necessarily be the case, and I'm personally disinclined to hand the term over to those who are indeed rigid and inflexible about Christianity. In an essay written some years ago, Rowan Williams identified two distinctly different approaches to the term orthodoxy. The first is a closed system. It's pre-packed, predetermined, watertight, a comprehensive ideology. This sort of orthodoxy stifles thought and distorts perception. There is no room for conversation within it. It's a monologue. No critical element is admitted. The reason that there's no conversation in this kind of orthodoxy is because actually everything has already been said that needs to be said, and all that's left to do is to repeat it again and again and again and again ad nauseam. There can be nothing new to say that isn't just a reiteration in different ways of what's already been said. Okay, the second approach to orthodoxy is basically what I'm calling progressive orthodoxy. Here, orthodoxy is seen not as pre-packed truth handed down from the past, but as a tradition of shared speech, a living community of revelation and dialogue, a tradition that invites a process of critical questioning. This approach to orthodoxy doesn't claim to possess the truth, simply to have perspectives on truth. Tradition's not a static and fixed thing, but it is dynamic and evolving. Progressive orthodoxy centres on a dialogue between the traditions of the past and the insights and struggles of now. It affirms that there are always new things to see and understand, that divine revelation is a constant process and not a once-and-for-all event in the past. In its own kind of pink and fluffy way, the film My Big Fat Greek Wedding is in fact all about this tension between tradition and progress, as you'll know if you've seen it. Tula, the central figure, clashes with her traditional Greek father when she falls in love with a non-Greek whom she wants to marry. She desperately wants to please her father, but she can't give up her new love. And in a moment of anguish, she pours out her heart to her brother Nick, who drops an unexpected pearl of wisdom when he says this: "Tula, don't let your past dictate who you are, but let it be part of who you will become. Don't let your past dictate who you are, but let it be part of who you will become." I wonder if this gem of popular cinematography perhaps offers a working definition of what I'm calling progressive orthodoxy, a faith that's deeply rooted in the originating sources of Christianity, but which recognises that the Holy Spirit continues to reveal new insights in the present situation. Those who follow this first approach, to orthodoxy, believe that their rigid conservatism is actually an act of faithfulness to the gospel. I disagree. Being faithful to the gospel does not suggest preserving it in precisely the same form that it was originally given. Parable of the talents is a good thing to reflect on in the light of that. Rather, being faithful entails reconfiguring and reinterpreting the message in order that it can connect with the new situations that are culturally and historically quite different to those of the original setting. My friend Maggie Dawn, who isn't here this year, encapsulates the point perfectly with her pithy remark, "We have to change to stay the same." In other words, in order to stay in continuity with Christian tradition, we must also engage with the radical discontinuity of cultural expression. Meaning isn't fixed, and if our religious language doesn't change, then far from maintaining continuity, it actually takes us away from the heart of the Christian tradition, or it may do. It's in a similar vein that Thomas Merton writes that to cling to the past is actually to lose one's continuity with the past, since this means clinging to what is no longer there. Progressive orthodoxy may not be a new label, but the idea is far from new. Indeed, this is how Christian tradition, I would say, has always worked. As John V. Taylor observes, the story of Christianity has been and always will be a series of impromptu responses to events. A religion, like every other system of ideas or body of tradition, stands in a context of exchange, affecting and being affected by its historical and social situation. Richard Hooker, of course, the 16th century architect of Anglicanism, marked out the ground for a progressive orthodoxy with his so-called three-legged stool, the notion that Christian truth exists in the interaction of scripture, tradition, and reason, and that none of these can be properly understood without the other two. In 1988, the Lambeth Conference decided that a fourth leg should be added, which was the experience of God's people. The biblical text, of course, remains constant, but reason and experience are continually changing, and tradition evolves out of the interaction between the text and contemporary expressions of reason and experience. So Christian orthodoxy shouldn't be understood as some fixed body of doctrinal or moral teaching, or as a rigid pattern of ritual or liturgy, but as a conversation between past and present, between scripture and reason, between tradition and experience. It's alive, not dead. Tradition is, and always has been, a conversation, a dialogue, an argument even. The Christian movement has always embodied conflicting points of view, always included debate, dispute, and disagreement. It is what Paul Ricoeur would call a conflict of interpretations. In contrast to this, the fundamentalist impulse is to preclude discussion, to exclude other perspectives, to bring premature closure to the argument by insisting that the fundamentalist view, and only the fundamentalist view, represents the authentic voice of Christian truth. And yet in the final analysis, the priority of the gospel lies not with textual debates or arguments, or with internal squabbling between conservatives and progressives, but with the liberation of human beings to be the whole persons that they might be, spiritually, physically, psychologically, emotionally, and every other thing. And the church's faithfulness to its message and tradition, I think, should ultimately be tested in terms of how effectively it helps to bring about that freedom. The Bible is at the very centre of Christian tradition, of course. And throughout history, the Bible has been the catalyst of human liberation. In 380 AD, for instance, it inspired Gregory of Nyssa to condemn slavery. In the 19th century, it led evangelical believers to help bring about the abolition of the slave trade. It's led Christians to fight poverty and injustice, to contend for greater equality of the sexes. And in our own day, it's inspired movements for justice, for fair trade, for peace and care for creation, and so on and so forth. And yet the Bible has also been a tool of tyranny and devastation. For 1400 years it was used to portray Africans as cursed by God and to justify their enslavement. It was used to sanction medieval witch hunts. Perverse biblical interpretation was employed to justify South African apartheid. It's still used to exclude women from ministry and leadership in the church, to oppress gay people and to destroy the environment. Clearly, the Bible can be used and abused in many different ways in order to serve many different agendas. The vast gulf between biblical times and our own times causes many people to treat the Bible as nothing more than a classical text, a piece of history that's undoubtedly helped to shape Western culture, but which has got no real relevance for us today. I reject that view. I feel like Paul Ricoeur, who features quite a lot in my book, that I want to say with him, I want to be called again. I want to be receptive to God's Spirit, mediated, albeit messily, through the oddity and ambiguity of this ancient text. It's by interpreting, Ricoeur says, that we can hear again. I've personally devoted the past 20 years of my ministry and my life to getting people involved in the process of reinterpreting the Christian message. goading them to share their doubts and questions, encouraging them to join the arguments, to share their ideas, insights and experiences, helping them to recognise that they can be part of creating Christian tradition rather than feeling that they are the victims of that tradition. Kenneth Burke, the literary theorist and philosopher, describes the drama of history as an unending conversation, and his portrayal of the drama of history could equally be a portrayal of Christian tradition. This is what he writes. Where does the drama of history get its material? From the unending conversation that is going on at the point in history in which we were born. Imagine that you enter a parlour. You come late. When you arrive, others have long preceded you, and they're engaged in a heated discussion. A discussion too heated for them to pause and tell you exactly what it's all about. In fact, the discussion had already begun long before any of them got there, so that no one present is qualified to retrace for you all the steps that had gone before. You listen for a while. Then you put in your oar. Someone answers. You answer him. Another comes to your defence. Another aligns themselves against you to either the embarrassment or gratification of your opponent, depending upon the quality of your ally's assistance. However, the discussion is interminable. The hour grows late. You must depart, and you do depart, with the discussion still vigorously in progress. It's a great image, I think, of history, but also a great image of Christian tradition. Progressive orthodoxy affirms the importance of Christianity's past, of the events and sacred texts that have given it shape and form and content, but it also maintains the imperative for Christianity to change and evolve through a constructive and critical engagement with the progressive movements of history. In order to remain faithful to the originating sources, Christian tradition must develop and change by engaging in this vigorous conversation between sources and memories from the past, experiences and insights from the present, and hopes and visions for the future. But there's another side to this, which I'd like to just flag up finally. Re-enchantment isn't just about learning new ways to think about the Christian faith. I think that's important. I think that Ricoeur is right. It's by interpreting that many of us can believe again. But it's not just about that. It's also about discovering some kind of spiritual reinvigoration, a fresh way to feel about God and Christian faith. Re-enchanted Christianity is what I'm calling spirited Christianity. Clearly, for a lot of people, the charismatic movement offers an appealing form of spirited Christianity. And yet there are also lots of others who are repelled by it, who choose to look for spiritual invigoration in other directions, including me. Sacramental spirituality, for example, offers many disaffected charismatics a more satisfying expression of the numinous. When asked a former house church colleague why he had shifted from a charismatic to an Anglo-Catholic church, he replied that it was the sense of mystery surrounding the Mass that attracted him. "I love the whole sensory thing," he said. "The incense, the colours, the bells, the music, the lyrical words of the liturgy, the taste of bread and wine. It's a mixture of mystery and rootedness." Now, he's not alone. An increasingly well-worn path exists between the charismatic and the sacramental. But there are other ways that people experience the numinous or spiritedness. Some find it in silence, contemplation and meditative practices. Some discover it in art, in listening to Rachmaninoff's Vespers, in singing along at a U2 gig, in climbing a hill or walking the dog, in sitting quietly in a beautiful building or in any of a thousand other activities, none of which automatically evokes the numinous, but all of which can. I don't think that there's any future for forms of religion, let alone Christianity, that fail to engage the human spirit, that fail to evoke a sense of the numinous, mystery, that behave as though religion is all about the mind or about controlled conventions or about conforming to rigid beliefs. I think this is why charismatic expressions of Christianity attract so much attention. However, much of the charismatic sector adopts some form of anti-intellectualism, a denial of understandings, insights and wisdoms from the 21st century. When I was working and spent my life in that charismatic sector, I was I was a misfit from quite a long way back, and I was once told by a charismatic that my problem was that I was in the mind. To which, of course, I replied, "Oh, I get it. So I'm supposed to be out of my mind, like you." Christian mission for the future, I think, requires both a reinterpretation of the Christian faith in the light of present-day insight and understanding, and a reinvigoration of God's Spirit that grips, excites, and inspires us to bring God's kingdom of justice and hope to the world, to spread a culture of life and liberation. We certainly live in a post-Christian era, but I don't believe that this means that people today are anti-God, anti-religion, or even anti-Christian. It means that they're disaffected by a church preoccupied with maintaining its own status quo, or which refuses to rethink its faith, or adapt its doctrines, or to properly integrate itself with the world of the present. But it doesn't mean that people are spiritually dead or disinterested in the sacred or the divine. I find people all the time outside of church are very spiritually alive and well. And it may seem strange for a vicar, but I often tell my parishioners who don't attend church regularly that I don't think God particularly needs them to come to church. Oddly enough, it has the strange effect of making them want to come. But I often say, if God really accepts or rejects people on the basis of whether they're part of his club, then I personally would not want anything to do with that kind of God. In a survey for the BBC in 2000, 76% of the British population admitted to having had a spiritual experience. And believe it or not, that is a 59% increase on a decade earlier. Amazing. And my own anecdotal experience suggests that many people are not looking for compelling evidence that God exists. Their hunger is much more directed toward spiritual experience and spiritual vitality. I tell you a little story about one funeral that I took a couple of years ago, which was actually the funeral of a four-day-old baby. He had a brother. They were both born prematurely, and it was thought that neither of them were going to live. And so when one of them did die, just 4 days old, the parents decided, painfully, that they would just keep him on ice until his other brother finally also died as well. Well, in fact, the other brother didn't die. In fact, he got better and better and stronger until they came to the point of feeling, we need to bury Gilbert. And so that was where I came in. And I was at this funeral. It was quite early in the morning. And obviously a tragic and sad event, after which we went to the pub, as is often the case. And I find it's usually the case that people see vicars or priests in pubs and all want to buy them a drink. And, and when it's still quite early in the day, it can be quite dangerous, really. But I realised when I did finally roll home at about 6 o'clock that day, I look back over what must have been about 40 or 50 conversations that I'd had with people that day, one after another, after another, after another, all of them, you know, about things spiritual and things important and about values and stuff going on, real stuff. They were all very good conversations. And I know if I'd stayed longer and been able to stand up longer, I would have had many more of them too. But when I went, as I was walking home, I thought, you know, isn't it interesting? Out of all those 40 or 50 conversations, I don't remember one of them asking me to justify why I believed in God. Not one of them asked that question. I actually think that 10 years earlier, that would have, 20 years earlier, certainly, that would have been different. That wasn't the issue. The issue for them was all about things that were going on in their lives or in people round about them. It was about experience and spirituality in the broad kind of sense, you know, was kind of on the agenda all the time. David Tacey, an Australian academic who's written extensively on contemporary spiritualities, and I thoroughly recommend his book, actually. It's called The Spirituality Revolution. And he argues that churches need to shift from being places of devotional worship to become centres of existential spirituality. It's quite a profound thought. They need to shift from being places of devotional worship to become centres of existential spirituality. By devotional worship, he's referring to forms of worship that are merely directed at cultivating personal piety rather than engaging positively with the world. I don't know about you, but I'm not interested really much in personal piety. I'm certainly interested in encounters with the divine, that leave me feeling cleansed, inspired, stimulated and renewed, re-spirited. But I'm really preoccupied with expressions of Christianity that lead me and others to make a difference in the world, to enhance justice, to promote fairness and compassion, to care for the spiritually, mentally or physically bruised and bleeding, to make the world a less violent, less self-possessed, more loving, more peaceful, more equitable place. That, I think, is what we call the kingdom of God. The church's dilemma in the opening decades of the 21st century is that, on the one hand, our faith has become unbelievable to many people because it's too often imprisoned in rigid interpretations of doctrine and dogma that no longer resonate or convince. And on the other hand, Christianity is no longer felt to be offering this existential spirituality to guide and energize people in their quest for hope and meaning and the sense of the transcendent. My book, Reenchanting Christianity, is my modest contribution to a process of both rethinking and re-spiriting the Christian faith. On the one hand, I'm offering thoughts and ideas that may help to reinterpret a Christian understanding of things like belief in God, the atonement, the resurrection, hell, and the afterlife, prayer, mission, so on and so forth. And on the other hand, I'm hoping to inspire a fresh connection to the heart and spiritual energy of Christian faith, resulting in re-spirited Christian communities. So progressive orthodoxy is the underlying methodology of the book, this vigorous conversation between past and present. I think we live, folks, you know, in extraordinary times in the Western world when church attendances seem to be diminishing, but spiritual hunger, I think, seems to be rising. This is not a time to withdraw into the security of old ways and old dogma. This is a time for reinterpretations, brave, even maybe thought to be reckless, reapplications of the Christian faith, rooted in the past, but fully integrated with the present. It's a time for re-enchantment, for re-spiriting, for re-energizing. In this book, I'm not describing a destination. It's not given as a manual for re-enchanted Christianity. I'm not talking about a destination. Rather, what I'm hoping to do is to fuel and to refuel a process, a journey of conviction, but openness. And I invite you today, and I invite you as you read this book, as I hope you will, to join me on this journey. Thank you for listening.
Dave, for a very stimulating, interesting talk that I'm sure has raised lots of questions in your mind. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, would you come down here so that you can speak into the microphone? There must be some people here who feel that what he's offering isn't re-enchanting them, or some people who would like to pass a comment.
Could I just say, as you may be coming down, that in our church, which is St. Luke's Church in North London, in Holloway, we have a program which is called Breathing Space, St. Luke's Centre for Spirituality, in which we're trying to kind of create this existential spirituality for people who wouldn't necessarily want to come to church. And I have some leaflets about our autumn program for that. So if you live, you know, in proximity of London, or you're interested in seeing what we're doing, there's a bunch of them down here at the front, and you're very welcome to take them afterwards.
Okay, we have a little queue. Just ask you to keep your questions or comments quite brief so that it gives Dave an opportunity to respond. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm conscious that lots of other Christian festivals are much more didactic and they tell you the right answer. And I just wondered how you see, if you like, those other sorts of Christians, perhaps with much more direct, particular ways of understanding. Is there a way that they can be reintegrated into your vision, or will there always just be a sort of mutual hostility?
Well, I'd like to feel not hostility. I don't feel hostile at all, and I certainly don't want to rubbish any other Christians who are struggling their way, as I have through my life, to find out, you know, what I really think and what Christian faith means. I've been at those festivals. I've been a speaker at those festivals. I've been a punter at them, you know. So I know what that's about, and I don't want to rubbish it because it was part of my journey. I'm very pleased that Greenbelt exists. It's one of the very few places in the Christian sector in this country where you don't get that kind of didactic kind of, where there isn't a Greenbelt line. Yeah, I think Greenbelt deserves a round of applause, don't you? But that there is a place of kind of openness, and I've met, you know, numerous people, even while I've been here now, and I've met them over and over again at Greenbelt, who've kind of, you know, taken the shift from the more didactic approach to conference going to a more open, kind of ended, imaginative one. And as I say, I don't want to be all pompous and arrogant about this, because we're all, as I say, trying to find our way to God. But I think that many people need Greenbelt and things like Greenbelt, places where they can explore, where they can question, where they don't have to believe what Dave Tomlinson or John Bell or Brian McLaren or anybody else says. They can argue with it, they can disagree with it, but at least there's something that's being explored, and where you find speakers at the same platform who don't necessarily agree with each other. We need more of that. So I guess the two will always coexist, is basically the answer to the question. But I hope not in hostility. I think that, you know, clearly there is a huge market today for certainty. There's no question about that. And I think that's against a backdrop of an emerging culture in which there is great uncertainty. And so I think, you know, it's understandable, and I have sympathy for why people want to rush for cover in kind of slick answers and secure kind of prepackaged answers, where they can just sit there and just feel a little bit more secure in this horrible, shaky world. I understand that impulse. I just don't think it's a very healthy one. And what I want to do is goad people all the time by throwing in the spanners, throwing the nasty questions in, you know. I mean, people at this, it's interesting actually to see how Greenbelt's changed. When the Post-Evangelical came out in 1995 here, for 2 or 3 years after that, I couldn't go through a seminar as I have now without having somebody heckle me and trying to shout me down. It's interesting that I haven't found that's happened in recent years. But one of the things that people used to say, you know, is, you know, it's time you read the Bible. You know, you're throwing the Bible away and da da da. I actually think I probably read the Bible a lot more than most of the people who say that. And very often what I would say to them is, when did you last read the book of Ecclesiastes? You know, the book of thank you for that. The book of Ecclesiastes is one of the big spanners in the works in the Bible that kind of just throws all the certainties into, you know, kind of confusion. And I think that's what we need. So yeah, you know, the two will go there. There's a market for that. I guess that's not my market, you know, if I can use such horrible terminology. My market is for the people who can't live with that, who are in danger of wandering away and thinking that it's all rubbish and there's nothing in it for them. And what I'm saying is, hey, there are other ways, there are other traditions, there are other approaches, and I represent one of them. This is not the definitive thing, but it's another way, you know?
Occasionally, used to go to an evangelical church in Barking, St. Erks, and the vicar there used to preach about homosexuality near enough all the time, and